So it had always been an issue that was on my radar and something that I wanted to tackle, but I didn't really know how.
This is Leaderful, where we give you the models and the frameworks, the strategies and the skills that you need to drive true transformation for yourself, your team, your organization, and the world. Welcome to the show. So, Ty, welcome to Leaderful. I'm really excited to talk to you about a wide range of topics related to workplace wellness, neurodiversity, building high performing, but also like teams that are well, you know, teams that are experiencing lots of meaning in their work. I know you've been doing some interesting work and research around the hybrid work experience that people are having. You're launching some things pretty soon about that. We're going to dig into it. So welcome. That's a long way of saying welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thank you so much. My pleasure to be here. And yeah, to engage with someone else that's, you know, very passionate about trying to make the workplace better and then really have that be the driver that makes everything else kind of follow through.
Yeah. So why don't we, before we jump into what you're doing right now, I'd love to get a taste of what the journey's been like for you to get to where you are now. Like, what are some of those highlights, the highlight reel, if you will, of your life experience, the work you've been doing and engaged in to center this in your work to get to a place of like, this is the most important thing that I could be working on. What, tell us about your journey.
Yeah. Formally, the journey starts when I was in college. Prior to that, I had some experience with mental health myself, and I had seen, you know, the repercussions of this within, you know, family, friends, colleagues, that sort of thing. So it had always been an issue that was on my radar and something that I wanted to tackle, but I didn't really know how. But then when I was in college, I realized that through studying neuroscience, that there's actually a lot of opportunity to really try to tackle that particular problem. So I kind of had this transition point from going from an engineering approach to being more of a science approach, but on the neuroscience side, and really things have started to fall into place since then. So once I decided to dedicate myself to understanding how the brain works, and by extension, how can we influence and manipulate in order to benefit people's wellness, I really started to find my niche when it came to technology-based psychological assessment. That's a bit of a mouthful, but more or less, I realized that all the ways that we use to understand people's psychological well-being and their mental health are very subjective in nature, and they're very biased. I'll share one quick story kind of related to that. When I was in college, I had a friend who was struggling with depression. This is what we believed at the time, but it turns out she actually had a thyroid cancer. And one of the side effects of hypothyroidism is that sometimes you show symptoms of depression. And for me, I found this incredibly frustrating because here she was being treated for completely the wrong medical condition because there wasn't a way to try to rule out that bias and, you know, to do the due diligence, to, you know, look into other potential medical causes. So from there, I really wanted to pursue a PhD in clinical psychology with a particular focus on neuropsychology, because that's much more about like cognitive testing and integrating like a medical history and all those other sorts of things to paint a really characterized picture of how someone's doing. And then as I was getting training for this, I really fell in love with the report writing side of it. So once you, you know, collected all this data, you did the interview with the person, you would do the cognitive testing, collect some questionnaires, get all their medical reports. At the end, there'd always be a list of recommendations or feedback for people that they could try to implement. And that was honestly for me, like the most fun part. It's like, okay, now we have this complete picture. How do we make your life better? How do we get this data to serve you in whatever capacity that might have meant for the potential clients? Unfortunately, it turns out I'm not the best therapist. So I wasn't very good at actually putting that feedback into action. But that experience of doing those assessments really influenced the way that I wanted to do my science moving forward. And then eventually led towards my journey in entrepreneurship.
Can I hit the pause button and inquire about how did you make that determination? How did you realize that the actual psychology, the practice of therapy wasn't a skill set? Was that something that you were experiencing? Was that feedback from clients? How did you kind of come to that realization that actually that I'm going to veer off in this direction instead?
All of the above.
All of the above. Okay.
Yeah. So this is actually an experience of burnout that I had myself. So when I went into the clinical psychology program, I did have some apprehensions about my efficacy as a clinician. I knew from the very beginning that like I want to be more on the assessment and science side of things, but doing the therapy is a part and parcel with that that training experience. And more or less, I didn't handle the stress from that particularly well. At that point, I didn't have a lot of really good support and structural systems set up. And my supervisor, my program, were really supportive of me through that journey and tried to give me whatever I could to improve that scenario. But basically, my client wasn't really getting better. There was other things were popping up, and it was really weighing heavily on me. So then when the option to switch into a primarily research track was presented, to me, it felt like this saving grace. I got a second chance to still do the research that I wanted and still be informed from my clinical experiences, but without the added stress of trying to manage someone else's behavior. Difficult job trying to get people to do things that they don't want to do for their own self-betterment. And I realized that that's not a skill set that I'm particularly well versed in, but I still like the data side of it. So I wanted to find how could I help out just from a different lens.
Okay. So you pursue the neuroscience meets research kind of track around wellness and particularly mental wellness. And where does that lead? Like, what is that trajectory? I want to get us to present day eventually, but between that point and now, what happened? You mentioned a shift into entrepreneurship earlier. What prompted that, and how's that journey been? And yeah.
So when I originally went off to do my PhD, I was really interested in brainwave technology. I thought, you know, brainwave recordings was this nice, relatively objective window into, like, you know, how people are, you know, thinking and feeling, that sort of thing. And that it could really complement and strengthen a lot of psychological assessment approaches. And in learning about doing the analysis for that, I actually fell in love with a statistical approach that comes from nonlinear dynamical systems theories, which is a fancy way of saying, like, measuring really complex things like mental health. And I realized that that approach actually lends itself really well to data that could be collected from smartphones. That's kind of where, like, the shift towards, like, entrepreneurship started to click in. So originally, I started coming up with this idea for an app that could be used for monitoring people on a more ongoing basis. So the idea is, instead of taking a snapshot of people like you typically would do in a psychological assessment, instead you do little mini snapshots, like, over a period of time, say a week or two. And then when you put those all together, now you get a movie or a video about what people are experiencing, as opposed to an individual photograph. And then the statistics I was learning really helped make sense of that video in a way that could be actually more beneficial. So this was still during the course of my PhD. So I tried to learn how to do web development, learned that that's actually really difficult to learn while you're also trying to learn how to be a professional scientist. So I kind of put that on the back burner. But then when the COVID-19 pandemic began, more or less all my research responsibilities kind of disappeared overnight. I was working with older adults for obvious reasons. We weren't continuing that research. You know, the rest of the world kind of shut down. So with this abundance of time that I had on my hands now, I recently met my business partner, and we decided we wanted to try to take this app idea and actually make it something. And then the other kind of a missing piece that I hadn't talked about so far is when I was doing these assessments with people, oftentimes we would have to warn them, like, hey, this is going to be incredibly tedious and boring. You're not going to like it, but it's going to give us really valuable data for creating that feedback. So when we were having the really early discussions about this app, it was really clear we wanted to have a gamification element to it, because at the end of the day, you want people, you know, engaged with their healing journey, and you need to find ways to make it, you know, fun and not tedious in order for, you know, people to use it, especially if they're otherwise struggling with mental health. So that's kind of where the shift to entrepreneurship happened. So we entered some pitch competitions, applied for a bunch of grants, found out that the community was really supportive about this idea. And that's where 8-Bit Cortex was born.
Okay. Let's talk about 8-Bit Cortex. And you're doing some research. You're doing a burnout study, I believe, on hybrid work, because that obviously is a new reality for a lot of people. It's either gone fully remote, or there's some sort of, you know, moving into this direction of hybrid in the office at home. And I'm guessing that the hope here with this study is to, like, what are the effects of this on people, right? And when we talk about, maybe let's define for the listener, and even for myself, I'd be curious about when you look at mental health, you know, I tend to look at, you know, I have background in addiction treatment. So addiction is certainly one of those things that shows up for people, anxiety, depression, you know, some of that, those are kind of the classic three that I think about when I think about mental wellness. But how do you characterize or define mental wellness? Where's the baseline that you're starting at, the things that you're looking to measure with this app, or just in general in your research?
Yeah. So I really take the technical term is transdiagnostic. So oftentimes we tend to get really hung up on particular labels, like, oh, like, I have depression, or I struggle with anxiety. But if you actually take a look from a neuroscience perspective, there's a lot of overlap. And psychiatrists tend to get really fussy about, you know, the labels and the diagnostics, that sort of thing. Whereas one of the things that I came out of my clinical psychology experience with is that if you take away the labels and just, like, you know, underlying, like, what is the fundamental psychological or neuroscientific process that gets you a little closer to the truth. So because of that, like, you know, our app isn't necessarily intended for, you know, one mental health diagnosis for another, but instead just as a general support for people that are otherwise struggling with their mental health. Typically, there's a few common things that tend to pop up across conditions. Again, you know, trans meaning, you know, across conditions. So I think one of the really important ones is attention. So that's kind of a foundational process for us. If you're not able to attend to information that's coming into the environment, you're not able to process it, put into your memory, put that into your goal planning, all that complex planning, that sort of thing, then you're not going to be very effective in life in many different ways. You know, professionally, personally, you'll feel kind of absent-minded in a lot of different ways. And that in and of itself tends to be a risk factor for many other kinds of mental health challenges. So oftentimes people with anxiety or depression will often report some degree of attention challenges as well. So that's kind of like, I would say, like the foundations, you know, let's measure attention and then look at other subjective mental wellness factors like stress, like happiness, a worry, self-reported focus, all those other sorts of things that don't neatly line up with a mental health diagnosis. But once you look at all those variables as a constellation, it actually starts to paint a fairly rich picture about what people might actually be going through.
Yeah. Speaking of attention, you maybe are hearing the thing on my phone, it's beeping at me and it's begging for my attention. And so like we could probably talk the rest of our time together about the decline of attention, the focus, the like just the systems that we've built around ourselves. But I do have a son with diabetes, so I got to just double check that his sugars are okay. He's at mountain bike camp today and I don't want him going too low. Apparently they were stuck on the chairlift. The chairlift stopped working. So, I'm just going to send him a quick note and then my attention is back to this conversation. But that little 20 seconds of my attention got pulled. And, you know, that's certainly a theme. And I love the transdiagnostic approach in addictions treatment. The first thing we really did was say, like, addiction's probably not the problem here. This is a symptom of a problem. And a lot of times, I think in the mental health, and maybe I'd love your take on this and your perspective, but a lot of times we're just chasing symptoms in the mental health world. You know, we're chasing, you know, ways to de-stress. And like yoga will take you so far. Mindfulness will definitely take you so far, but as a band-aid for underlying systemic stressors and things that are like this distress in other ways, they tend to be, we can chase those symptoms a lot versus get underneath the hood and say like, what's really happening here, right? Is what's this connected to? Short stories. I love the approach when it comes to someone. So someone listening to this podcast and they're responsible for a team or they themselves are like obviously responsible for their own wellness, but they're thinking about like, oh man, I don't actually know how I'm doing, or I don't actually know how the people on my team are doing. What's a good first step for somebody to take that isn't just symptom reduction or isn't just aimed at, you know, kind of blindly? I poke at this. I'm a little skeptical of some of the wellness industry, this like health and wellness industrial complex, I call it, where it's like, you know, we can just have this like treadmill of interventions that deal with symptoms. And it's just like, doesn't solve anything. It's kind of an addiction. Like addiction is really good at short-term alleviation of symptoms. Right. If I'm distressed and I use a substance and that takes my stress away, that's a really good, and I see the system kind of doing that in a lot of ways with a lot of trainings and workshops and webinars and like these things. It's like, you know, at some point we have to get under the hood. We have to peel it back and say like, what's really going on here? Where's this stress coming from? And how do we then approach that? So that's I don't know if there's a question. There's probably a question buried in there somewhere for you to respond to, but it's a statement. I'm making a statement and I'd love to hear your response to that statement.
Yeah, no. I think that the perspective that you're bringing there is incredibly valuable. I think actually addiction is a really good kind of anchoring point, I think, kind of for my response. So you said that addiction is often not the problem itself. It's often a symptom of the underlying problem. And I think that that's very true. So again, if you're able to find out like, you know, why is someone wanting to use the substance? Like what's the underlying drive? Like, as I said, you know, it's giving some degree of, you know, short-term alleviation of pain, or maybe it's a procrastination technique or something along those lines. Once you understand like what's the reason why people are seeking that out, then that informs you like, okay, well then how do you develop an alternative coping strategy that is not that particular substance? And oftentimes like the specific substance and why people are using it in itself can be like very informative. And then when you're trying to get towards those underlying causes, I think it's really important, again, going back to that nonlinear dynamical systems perspective, is appreciating that there's a lot of complexity that goes into that. So when it comes to someone's own like health and wellness, like there's their own personal contribution. You know, did you do X, Y, and Z in order to take care of yourself today? But there's also, more societal and systemic contributions as well. You know, do you feel safe or threatened in your job situation? Do you have anxiety about the economic outlook? Is your family and your social support network actually supportive of you? And all these other things are things that are beyond ourselves, but influence us. And there's a give and take relationship. And when you're trying to get towards those underlying sources, I think we have to really keep in mind that it's not just the individual, it's also the situations, the environments that they find themselves within. So whenever I try to approach situations, when I was doing the clinical training, it was always, what does the individual bring to the situation? And what is the environment they're operating in? And typically you have to change something about both. If you're asking the individual to make all these changes, but you're not changing anything about the environment, it's probably not going to work. They're going to, you know, have a good attempt at it, but it's not going to be sustainable behavior change. And at the same time, you can make the workplace or their environment more accommodating. But if the individual isn't bought in that something needs to change, then it's not going to make as much of a difference anyway. So it really needs to be the synergy of both of those. And I think that's often lost on people, that they always want to be like, you know, one or the other.
For sure. And I think that the system that we're a part of, when I think of, like, there's a lot of individualism. We live in a very individualistic society. And so there is a tendency, I think, for the system to frame mental wellness as an individual problem. It's like, Ty, you go work on your X, and Jeff, you go work on your Y. Not recognizing that there's such a mutuality between how I experience life and you experience it with the people in our life and the systems and structures that we're a part of. And so I think, and it shows in a lot of self-help, you know, literature. You know, I call it literature, but it's, you know, the latest self-help guru who says, just take responsibility and pick yourself up by your bootstraps. Some version of grit and personal resiliency is sorely lacking in the nuanced conversation of, like, yes, that, and the how you function in the world and how the world functions to you and the level of power. Like, we end up talking about power here a lot at the Ally Co, and understanding power dynamics, because I have a certain amount of personal power for sure. And then I run into the fact that I don't have that role in society. I need somebody else's support. I need my doctor to help me, right? Or I need my therapist to help me, or I need my coach, or I need whoever, right? And so, yeah, a more nuanced perspective, I think, on mental wellness is sorely needed for most people. And because there's a lot of shame that goes around, I think, with mental illness, certainly an addiction, you know, we would half jokingly call it a shame disorder. If it's anything, if it's a disorder, it's a shame disorder, right? It's a way to cope with some of the very real shame that people carry around the pain they have. Not to go off on a tangent on any one particular avenue with mental wellness, but a lot of my reflections are usually through the lens of addiction. Yeah. So back to the person who, like, a first step might be recognizing that it's complex. There's multiple factors at play, and recognizing if you're a leader of a team or you're a manager in an organization, like, what can I actually control that has an impact on my team members? What are you finding in your research or in the people that you talk to about mental wellness? Let's maybe locate it in the workplace for now, because I know that that's a lot of the work that you're doing. That's a lot of work that we do. And so it makes sense for us to talk about, how does this conversation show up in the workplace, and how can people be more intentional about promoting and supporting wellness? We could talk a little bit about diversity and neurodiversity in particular. When we talk about attention, like, it's a really interesting place. We could start to talk about how people experience the workplace with, when neurodiversity is we start to factor that in. Love your take on that. But this will be a choose your own adventure at this point, Ty. You can take it where you want to take it.
Yeah. So I guess the first thing is you need to have the information before you can act on it. So I think the first thing is, you know, just trying to take stock, you know, how does your team feel? How do you feel? And this can take lots of different forms, depending on how, like, you know, data driven you want to be. But the most simple thing that people can do is just, you know, asking their colleagues, like, how are you doing? You know, is your workload appropriate? Do you feel like you're supported? Is there aspects about the work environment that make you feel unsafe in any capacity or uncomfortable? And just being aware of those kinds of factors and, you know, getting that information from your team actually can really inform a lot of things right from the get-go.
I'm gonna interrupt, and I'm gonna push back just gently on that approach, only because when we layer power dynamics into the conversation, it changes the questions that you can ask. Am I getting the truth from this person, or am I getting what I think they want me to hear? Yes. And that's really hard when you layer power in. The CEO can go to an employee and say, hey, how are you doing? And it's like all thumbs up and smiles. When their colleague leans over and says, how are you really doing? It's, oh, this is terrible, and I'm suffering, right? So who is asking the questions is important. And I mean, as a third party who often comes in to have these conversations, that's part of the role that we take, is to try and neutralize some of those power dynamics that can mess with that question. Because sometimes when we ask that question of how you doing, we get the thumbs up when it's not true. And just caution, I'd love your take on that, because that also sometimes people don't ask the question, and not asking the question, that's an act of power too. And so I think it's a nuanced conversation, but I do think that that conversation has to be started, I think. But maybe the take home for me here, as I wrestle through my own thinking on this, is that the people need to be intentional. So if you are the HR manager, if you are the CEO, recognizing that I might not actually get very good answers to this question, so maybe I should get Jeff and his team to come in and do it. Maybe I should get Ty to come in and bring his app in and to get some data from the system so that we get the themes, or we get closer to the truth of what people are experiencing, as opposed to, you know, I just see lots of like very different responses depending on who's asking the question. That's the take home. I'm going to pause it there because I totally interrupted you to go on a tangent about power, inappropriate use of power. I'm leveraging my power as the host, and I'm going to give it back to you.
No, actually, I think your tangent was a really good direction to take, because I was saying that's the first step that kind of needs to be taken, but the strategy and how you implement that step, there's a lot of nuance that goes into it, as you just articulated. So as a scientist, I always try to approach this from how can we start trying to reduce bias? And there's lots of different ways you can start going about trying to do that. So it sounds like from a lot of the work that you do, you're much more about how can we have a third party potentially come in and, you know, have those difficult conversations, you know, in a mediated capacity, in order to, as you said, neutralize some of those power dynamics and get more genuine responses. So I think there's a lot of value in that. Oftentimes a third party is able to see things that, you know, people that are in the heat of the moment might not be able to. And oftentimes you can elicit responses out of people that you might not otherwise get. You know, if you ask a question versus the CEO asks a question, you will probably get a much more genuine answer. As a scientist, I tend to lean, and specifically a neuroscientist, I try to lean how can we use other sources of data and information to try to inform that question? And I guess this is where the app that we're building comes in. So the way that we structure our service is we'll have people interact with our app for about a week or so. We call it a wellness sprint. And the idea is that we're doing just a very gentle touch in with people, you know, 10 minutes or less a day, you know, ask them a super brief questionnaire, check in with their emotions and their feelings, have them play a game that measures their cognitive attention capacity. And then look at how that starts to paint a movie across time. And then based on that data, then I feel I'm able to get a much more complete picture of how things are going on. And then the devil is always in the details, because once you start having that data, then you can start drilling down what stands out? What seems like it's not quite right? And then you can start looking at things is there inequalities in the health and wellness in the workplace? You know, is this group of people that, has relative power, are they actually doing fairly good? And is the people that are disadvantaged for some reason or don't have as much power within the organization, are they not doing quite so good? And if you start to find that there are those inequalities, then you have data for how you can start strategizing to adjust those inequalities.
Yeah, it's that in aggregate, you can then start to see what's happening structurally and systemically, as opposed to, again, individualizing it and making it, this is just about Jenny and her health and wellness, and we need to support her. It's the patterns that emerge, I think, from that effort, I think, are really important. And I know that would emerge from the data that you're collecting. And that's certainly an approach that we take, is it's actually less about the very, at the very individual level. It's what are the themes here? And what can we as a business take on at the system level? Interestingly, I'm having a flashback to a workshop that I did a couple of years ago, and it's about 40 managers. We did a self-care kind of assessment. It's a self-assessment on your self-care and your satisfaction with your self-care in a couple of different domains, just a light touch, kind of one of those workshop self-assessments, just to inform some reflection and conversation. And when I pulled the data, there was a group that was just suffering, just low across the board, and it was working mothers. Right. Mm. It was working mothers were just getting hammered in this workplace with the distress and stress and not able to cope and not able to do what they needed to do to be well. So I guess that's a segue into are there some groups? Are there some things that you're noticing, trends in the data? I I mean, I go right back to power dynamics and like, well, they have less power in lots of different ways than other people do. And so they're less able to meet their own needs. But what are you seeing in the data that you have so far, or in the even anecdotally, what your experiences have been with the teams or the conversations that you're having about like who's doing well, who's not doing well, how would we know, what might we do?
Yeah. So I'm going to give the most scientific and potentially unsatisfying response and say that it depends. Yeah, because basically, look, I mean, for those kinds of that data, like it really depends on the individuals that make up a group, and then you know what power structures is that group embedded within, and depending on you know who's making that up, it often can look a very different way. Mm-hmm. So, like, I mean, with the workshop that you mentioned, you would identify like you know like working mothers in particular seem like they were not supported, and they were starting to incur you know these health risks. Going back to like, you know, hybrid work and burnout, I think this is a really good topic to actually make this really concrete. So say you have a person that's really extroverted, let's say they, you know, they typically do sales or something along those lines. Those are the kinds of people that actually will really enjoy going into the office or going to, you know, networking events, those sorts of things. And that kind of situation aligns really well for them. So in this case, like that needs to be a component of how their work environment is structured to really support, you know, their tendencies and predispositions and how they want to interact with the company. Whereas if you take someone that is more introverted, let's say they're a software developer, really probably what they want to do is, you know, be in their home and write their code, submit their GitHub push and pull requests, you know, on their relative time. And when they have the option, do that from somewhere other than their house or remotely, you know, while traveling. So those, because of that, it starts to get really challenging to make very general kinds of statements, because it really does all depend on, you know, all those interacting layers within the hierarchy. So there really isn't a general thing that's kind of pulling out so much as, I guess, try to appreciate the context, and wherever possible, see if you can break a group down into smaller, you know, subunits within it. That's what the dynamical systems theory is all about. How can you understand those individual components within the larger complex system and how they're interacting? Until we're able to collect a lot more data, I won't be able to say anything generalizable at this point. The data we've collected is, you know, a very, very team specific.
And I actually appreciate that answer, because that's the truth, right? Like it is so contextual. And that same organization, if the CEO had been a working mother, that they might have had the best wellness, because she prioritizes that and she empathizes with that group, and she puts structures in place to make sure that they're doing well. So you're right, it is so contextual inside of the team that you're part of and the organization, and yeah, I guess the level of what they orient towards as far as a workplace experience goes, right? So tell me more about you're running a study. Have you launched a study? You are launching a study about working remotely?
Yeah, so we'll be launching it relatively soon. I think by the time this podcast is released, it'll be out. Okay. So basically, we want to try to understand this issue of hybrid work in a little bit of greater detail. Through a lot of the conversations we've been having, it seems like this is something that business leaders would like to know about, but don't have any data or insights to really work on. So right now, it seems like it's a lot of top-down enforcement of policy. So you have your CEOs like, we're an office culture company, so everyone's coming back into the office, not realizing that actually they lead a software development company and most of their employees would rather stay working from home. Or, you know, the flip side is, well, we want to be very accommodating to all of our employees, and as a result, you know, everyone's allowed to work from home, but then not realizing that that takes away some accountability within the workplace, and maybe people aren't, you know, as engaged, not as productive, and the company overall could start to suffer that way, even though individual people might feel like they're perhaps a little bit more empowered that way. More or less because of that, we want to see if we can find, you know, what can we say that is generalizable? So, you know, trying to think about, you know, what are those individual subgroups, and once you have those identified, what kind of makes sense? And when it comes to hybrid work, the personality dimension of introversion, extroversion, my hypothesis is that that's going to be really most critical, and that, you know, how extroverted or introverted your team is really going to inform how you should structure your hybrid work environment. Yeah. And then of course, like, you know, what kind of industries are people in? What, you know, what kind of, you know, other obligations people have outside of work? You mentioned working mothers. I think that's another group that really benefits from a hybrid work model. Cause, you know, if they're able to balance some of their, you know, domestic and family responsibilities with their work responsibilities by working from home, like that's going to leave them feel empowered. And yeah, maybe they're not going to be, you know, as productive as if they were to come into the office. But over the long term, when you think about like the return on impact of that strategy, it will pay, you know, dividends towards the company. But in the long term, whereas you might not necessarily see that in the short term.
Yeah, no, it's going to be an interesting, you know, evolution of our attitudes and perspectives. And you're right, there isn't a great data out there right now about what the actual experience is like. And into the subgroups, we have a lot of opinions. You know, I think actually Malcolm Gladwell was in the news the other day for spouting off about his opinions about this. And it's like, well, unless it's actually data informed and, like you said, contextual, and we probably shouldn't have an opinion on it. We should probably do some research. And so I love that you're taking on the task for us, for all of us, at, you know, digging into this. And so we'll probably have some links at this point. By the time this show is live, we'll put some links out with this episode and people can check that out and check out the work of 8-Bit Cortex and the research that you're doing and get engaged, because it is a critical piece. We, you know, actually, and here's a, you know, quick story. I apparently have lots of stories of talking to CEOs about their organizations. I guess that's what I do a lot of that now. And I had a conversation with a couple of managers in addictions treatment in that I had supported over the years, and they were describing a workplace of high levels of burnout. People were not doing well, right? And they're short-staffed, overworked, underpaid, like all of those dynamics were at play. And they're a year and a half into the pandemic, and they described this like, and I'm like, okay, well, we need to focus on wellness. They wanted me to do some outcome and evaluation work with them. And I'm like, I don't think that's where you're at. Like, it doesn't sound like that's going to be as effective, you know, outcome and evaluation for your client experience when you are like hitting the wall every day. Just doesn't seem like it's a good priority. So I talked to the CEO and she's like, oh, Jeff, I put so much money into health and wellness, so much money over the past years. It's been a top priority. So she was super frustrated to hear that it was still a problem in the organization. But it turned out that where the money was being spent wasn't aligned with what was meaningful to the people. So we're taking action, right? But it's just not very nuanced, or it's not targeted action. It's like, oh, I have this assumption about what's going to be important, so I'm going to make that the priority. And we do that in the absence of data. We make assumptions. We center what we would find meaningful, right, as the leader. And then we take action on that. And we see a lot of that right now. That CEO who says we're an office first culture, it's probably he's an office first culture because he's a sales, like ex-sales guy who's an extrovert and wants people around to talk to, right? Like that yes. ends up being what that conversation really is if we dig into it. So yeah, long way of saying, you know, we don't often know what is true for other people, and we need to be curious and we need to discover what that is. And I love that you're taking a systematic data-driven approach to that. You know, we do that at the culture survey level, at the like what's here for a culture. And I love that you have this kind of individual, because my assumption is that individuals would then, when they interact and use the app, are going to get a report or a reflection or some sort of meaningful, like, here's what this shows and here's what you could do to improve your app, that gamification side that you mentioned. Can you maybe talk us through a little bit more what that user experience is on the app, or what you envision it to be? I know it's probably still unfolding as you grow.
Yeah. So I'll use this in the context of the hybrid work burnout study, since that's what I imagine a lot of your audience would potentially engage us with. So basically, it would be 7 days of interacting with our app. And each day when you sign in, you'll be prompted to do a very brief questionnaire, you know, just 2 or 3 minutes. Then you'll rate your feelings. It'll measure different social determinants of health, which is a fancy way of saying all that context that is otherwise missed. As well as that gamified cognitive test. And then doing that for 7 days, again, we're able to paint that movie for people. And then at the end of that 7 days, people could then, as individual users, can go onto a dashboard and see how their data is plotted and start to use some of our algorithms to try to identify what is actually working for them. So just to give my own anecdote from this, I was using the app and trying to, you know, monitor myself. And it turns out that when I exercise and go into nature, I perform better on the cognitive task than if I don't do that. So now I know that as part of my strategy, like, you know, if I'm feeling overwhelmed or struggling with the heat, because we're currently in a heat wave, I know that what's actually beneficial for me is not necessarily to, you know, be, you know, gritty and, you know, try to push through it, but it's actually, you know, perhaps take a break, go for a run, you know, go take a moment down by the river. And then when I do return to work, I'm in a much more refreshed and focused state, and I'm able to often be quite a bit more effective that way. So that's what individuals are able to get out of our app is, you know, all the data that they collect, they're able to get, you know, insight into how they can build up their personalized strategy. The content we include within our app is also personalized for them. So that way they're able to, you know, get these little nuggets of and tips on how to have a wellness strategy that's specific for them and their personality and neurodiversity constellation factors. And then at the organizational level, we can do that, but at a broader aggregate, like, okay, you know, here's the themes that are starting to emerge. You know, here's, you know, those inequalities. Here's the groups of people that are, you know, benefiting from this. Here's the groups of people that are not benefiting from that. And then, as you said, you know, you can pump a lot of money into health and wellness, but if you're not actually verifying that it's being spent on the right kinds of things, then it might not actually make a difference. Maybe the dental plan isn't driving outcomes. Maybe it's your psychology appointments. I shouldn't say that. Dentistry is important.
Important to some people, right? Important.
Yeah.
And that's the point is, that one size fits all approach tends to get taken when it comes to health and wellness in the workplace. And this moves us more to what I would call like a one size fits one, right? Like what works for Jeff, what works for Ty. Right. And that's inevitably going to be more meaningful and more productive at the end of the day for everyone to engage in that level of individualization, which I think we can do now because we have technology for it. Right. We have like these smartphones that are dinging off in our pockets. We can use them for good as opposed to using them solely for distracting ourselves and scrolling TikTok, which I love the gamification aspect of things because you are like there's stiff competition for people's attention in the world mm-hmm. today. And so we have to think about that. We have to bake that, start baking that into our approaches, I think, for sure. What haven't we talked about that seems important? I know we had touched on some neurodiversity, and I would actually love to dig into that because we're seeing more interest. And I think we're going to queue up a lunch session with you to come in and talk with the community around neurodiversity in particular and how that shows up in the workplace. But do you have some experiences or perspectives on how we can be with neurodiversity? Because there's been a big conversation in society the past couple of years about being with other diversities, right? Whether that's ethnic diversity or gender identity and those types of things. Neurodiversity is, I would say, new. It's a fairly fresh conversation in the space anyway, around workplace culture and wellness. I'm going to pass it over to you to take us where you want to take us when it comes to how do we think about accommodations and or like evolving the workplace to be more accommodating to neurodiverse individuals.
Yeah, no, I think you actually started going down that path by saying instead of a one size fits all approach, like a one size fits one approach. So the thing is, when you typically think about like diversity, you know, you think about things like gender, ethnicity, age, you know, socioeconomic status, and those are all like very relevant factors. But it's missing an entire dimension of diversity that often isn't necessarily looked at. You know, you could have, for example, you know, two Indigenous people, but, you know, if one of them struggles with, you know, ADHD and some anxiety, they're going to have a very different experience going through life, even though if you just look at those more surface level demographic factors, that's not necessarily going to pop through. So I think neurodiverse is kind of like the next a frontier for really trying to make the workplace more inclusive. And this is just my hypothesis, but I would argue it's getting much closer to a lot of the problems that people are actually experiencing. So just to kind of, you know, back up a little bit and, you know, kind of define what neurodiversity is and kind of where it came from and where I think it's going as a term. It originally came from looking at people that were struggling with autism spectrum disorder. And traditionally, this is a population of people that tended not to do very well in society. You know, they had, you know, some challenges with social skills and, you know, restricted interests. And as a result, like these people often didn't find the kind of fulfillment or happiness that you often might find. But then Silicon Valley happens and suddenly now you've got this place where the people that are kind of a little socially awkward, you know, but are really into technology, now suddenly have an environment where they're thriving. And I think there's actually some data where if you look at rates of autism spectrum disorder, it's actually much higher in kind of like the Silicon Valley area compared to, you know, other communities. So it really does show that when you have a group of people where their brain is just different in some way, doesn't necessarily matter which way, but in some way, and you're able to find an environment that clicks with the way in which it's different, it can be incredibly empowering. So that was kind of, I'd say, like the first wave of thinking about neurodiverse is really kind of like specific, kind of like with autism, and was actually kind of led by like the tech sector that way. But now it's starting to be expanded into a much broader definition. So kind of the next wave that was coming from there was looking at ADHD and different kinds of learning disabilities. Because again, those are developmental in nature. So it's easier to say, like, you know, this is my brain, not me. So, you know, people with ADHD, you can have accommodations for them. If you think about classroom settings, most you're probably most familiar with, you can give people a little bit of extra time on tests. You can give them a little, you know, a secluded room where they're not going to be as distracted by other things. If they have a learning disability, that you can have people, you know, retest to them, those sorts of things. So I got some exposure doing that kind of accommodations when I was doing my clinical training in graduate school. And it really got me thinking about how work environments, in this case, was an academic work environment, could start to be personalized and adapted to really support individual people. And then where I think that this is going is really having neurodiversity extend to include most kinds of mental health conditions. The approach that I really take when it comes to mental health is called developmental psychopathology, which again goes really hand in hand with a transdiagnostic approach. And it basically argues that mental health conditions don't come out of nowhere. They have a developmental trajectory. And if you start to look back through people's life, you can start to see the signs of, you know, where it's coming from, like where, why their environment promoted their brain to develop and adapt in that kind of way. And then the challenge then becomes like, okay, well, given that your brain wants to operate in this way, rather than forcing you to change your brain, how can we do things to restructure your environment ever so slightly to work better with your brain? And then this is where the one size fits one approach comes in. This gets incredibly complex once you start looking on a case-by-case basis. But that general overall perspective of how can we understand what people are going through and try to be more accommodating and find out where their strengths are, where their weaknesses are, and supplement their weaknesses so they can really lean into their strengths, I think is really at the heart of the neurodiversity movement.
Yeah, I love that. It's not necessarily about fixing people. It's about fixing the environment that people are within. You know, it's that old analogy of, you know, when a flower isn't growing, you don't pull it out, you pull the weeds out and you water it and you change the place that it's growing. How do you handle or what are some of the objections to this movement, or like what do you hear barriers or obstacles that people are facing when it comes to tackling neurodiversity in the workplace? Are you running into people who are like, yeah, that'd be great, but this and this?
Yeah, I think probably the most interesting kind of obstacle that I've encountered, and this goes back to something we talked about earlier, where there's this, when it comes to mental wellness, there's a component that the individual brings, and there's a component that the environment brings, and then mental wellness is the intersection between those two. So I think there's a tendency, as you were suggesting earlier, for people to think like, you need to do something to fix your own brain. And you know, that's your responsibility, and kind of shy away from like what your responsibility in the more systemic environmental piece. So I think that's one barrier that we're still kind of facing. And this isn't a particularly new one. This is, you know, the stigma that's come around mental health for a long time. The more recent kind of challenge that I think has been popping up is people want to be supportive and they want to, you know, find ways to make the workplace more accommodating and empower people. But they're reluctant to go, have that responsibility piece as well. It's almost like they feel like by being accommodating in the workplace, they don't need to require people to be as accountable or responsible. Whereas if you look at the clinical psychology literature, actually both of those coming together is where the magic happens. Mm-hmm. Again, you change the environment, you know, in order to work better with people's brains. And then those people are, you know, bought in and they're trying to make a difference. And that's where things really start to happen. Whereas I feel like right now there's a tension where people are thinking that mental wellness is either an individual responsibility or society needs to change. But there's less of a nuanced conversation about how do we make both of those come together at the same time? Because they feel like they're at odds, but I really don't think they are. I think that it's entirely possible to, you know, hold people to account, empower them to, you know, make their own changes while simultaneously, you know, finding ways to restructure the environment to make their efforts go farther.
Yeah, no, I love that perspective. And yeah, I agree. I think that there's a responsibility, accountability piece that people are like, where is that line? Right. And it's just, I think people, you know, my perspective on this is that potentially some people see a slippery slope of accommodating. Like once you start accommodating one thing, then you have to accommodate the next thing and then the next thing. And then when is the work going to get done? Or when is the productivity going to happen? Or when is, you know, X, Y, or Z? And I think you're right. I think it's that. And that can like withhold accommodations for everyone. Or there's a fairness piece. It's like, well, if I give you this, then I have to give so-and-so that, as opposed to, and that's, again, I think it's rooted in a one-size-fits-all approach that oftentimes leaders take on because it's easy or it's easier. to just say no to things because this is the rule, this is the policy, or this is the way we do things here, which is never a good reason to do anything because it's the way we've always done it. And we know that. I really appreciate your time. Any last requests for the audience, someone listening to this, what action they can take besides checking out obviously 8-Bit Cortex and the work that you're doing with the app and getting involved with the hybrid burnout study. What can people do today, right now, to take action on what we've been talking about today?
This is where I kind of put like my big picture hat on. And I think that if we can do a better job of listening to people, a lot of these problems that you and I have been talking about start to become just a little bit more self-evident. Mm-hmm. So I think really trying to understand what other people are going through is crucial to, it sometimes can give us insight into ourselves. And once you start having that and see where there's, you know, alignment across people or where there's differences across people, then we can start thinking about, okay, how do we do like the one size fits one as opposed to the one size fits all approach? And there's this fun thing when you spend time listening to people, they want to listen to you back. So there's this reciprocity piece. So it's this really counterintuitive process whereby, you know, taking a step back and listening and, you know, trying to be supportive for other people, you end up getting support in and of yourself. And then that actually can be one of the best things that we can do for overall mental wellness. There's been some a lot of research on the neuroscience side of things, looking at different kinds of stress hormones. And one of my favorite stress hormones is oxytocin, which isn't typically thought of as a stress hormone. But basically what oxytocin does is take, well, given that you're under stress, if you have social support, how do we mitigate the negative consequences of that stress? So it kind of takes a stressful circumstance and transforms it from being this threat that, you know, is existential or overwhelming. And it transitions it over into being a challenge that could be overcome because you have the resources and the support necessary to do so. So I think wherever we can find that empathetic connection between other people, I think it's, you know, going to serve the community better and ultimately serve ourselves better. So yeah, just pay attention to people a little bit more and, you know, mindfully listen.
Be a little more curious and a little more compassionate. I love it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ty. I appreciate your time. Great chat. And we are going to get you into a learning and action session. So if you're listening to this soon after it comes out, you should jump on the website and check out a lunchtime session where we're going to open up Q&A. We'll talk about this with the audience and a community of folks who are really interested in this work that you're doing. So I appreciate you and I appreciate what you're bringing to the world. So thank you for joining me.
All right. And thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure. This was a lovely discussion.
Leaderful is brought to you by The Ally Co., a team of human-centered, systems-conscious consultants, coaches, and facilitators dedicated to helping you and your team tackle the core problems of burnout and stuckness and misalignment and misuses of power and all of the things that get in the way of creating truly human-centered workplaces where everyone thrives and does their best work. Head over to www.theallyco.world to learn more.